All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm speaking to you from the borough of Queens in New York City. It is the 17th day of May, 2023. I'd like to also remind you that I am the editor of a newsletter called Jay Taylor's Gold, Energy, and Tech Stocks, and I think it's a very exciting time to look at this sector, the companies that are exploring and developing massive gold deposits and silver deposits, some copper thrown in there as well. Some very interesting opportunities, I believe, and most of the market is pretty oblivious to it. But you know, as gold seems to have broken through that $2,000 ceiling, it might be a good time to pay some attention to the juniors that are starting to develop world-class gold deposits. And there's several of them in my newsletter that I cover. One of those companies I'm going to be bringing to your attention today when Dr. Quentin Henning joins me in the second segment of today's show. It's a company with a very low market cap, a Canadian exploration company operating in British Columbia and on to what appears to be, well, at least potentially a several million ounce gold deposit in the making, fairly high grade as well. So if you join me in the second segment of today's show, Quentin Henning will be talking about that company. And it is one, as I say, that I cover in my newsletter. Would also like to encourage you to, if you like the show, to subscribe to the channel and hit the like button at the bottom of the screen. I've titled today's show, Gold is Always Money. Why? Well, the title of today's show, of course, comes from Alistair MacLeod's most recent or a recent article that he's written. Gold is always money, he declares. Well, that's been true over thousands of years in the minds of most people, but over recent years, the last 100 years or so, we've been taught that that's not the case. It's been called a barbaric relic, for goodness sakes. Why would you want to hold a barbaric relic when you can have modern money, for goodness sakes? So, well, this idea of money, some different kind of money, not money at all, according to Alistair. He's going to tell us why in just a moment. Alistair, thank you so much for joining me today.
That's my pleasure, Jay.
Yeah, so, you know, you wrote in your letter, you said it's commonly believed today that money is the currency that central banks make, they create in the form of notes. And quite frankly, that's what I think of as money. I have dollar bills that I carry around in my wallet. They work perfectly well. I go to the store, I can buy pretty much what I want with them. So they seem to work pretty well, but why are dollar bills that I carry around not actually money?
Well, everything you use as money is in fact credit, including gold, because it is, if you like, the fruits of your labor or the profits of your labor, which you have yet to spend. So in that sense, it's credit. But the difference between gold and dollars is gold has no counterparty risk. Your dollars does have counterparty risk. Your counterparty is a central bank whose finances look definitely very ropey. So, you know, that is essentially the difference. And the definitions, if you like, of effectively money, we call it money to distinguish it from paper credit, from a promise, if you like, to pay in real money at a future date. We distinguish it from that by calling gold, silver, and copper. I mean, that's metallic, solid, counterparty-free means of exchange, currency, whatever you like to call it. But we'll call it money just so that we can differentiate it from the rest. Mm-hmm. And the rest is comprised of central bank credit, which is the dollar notes that you have in your wallet, and also bank credit, which is represented to you in the form of a deposit account, which is actually nothing more than an obligation by the bank to owe you to pay on your demand the amount that's shown in your account. So that's the essential difference between the two. And it's been like that all the way from Roman times. I mean, there's the attempts to sort of define these things really started with the 12 tables in about 448 BC. Mm. Interestingly, according to a Roman juror called Gaius, who wrote about this, I think in about the early 2nd century AD, mm-hmm. That was the time when the first Roman coins came out. And the first Roman coin was something called the ius. Mm-hmm. And the ius was a third of a kilo of bronze. So it was a pretty big lump. Yeah. And that sort of got refined and refined as time went on. But I mean, the reality of it is that before the ius, I mean, there were other coins elsewhere, but if you looked at the Phoenicians, for example, they had no money in the form of coinage until the Romans effectively started with theirs. So they had been trading for over 1,000 years before then with no money. So how do they do it? Well, it had to be credit, because if you think of yourself, let us say, trying to get together an expedition to go and procure things from foreign lands, you'll do two things. You'll probably take sort of urns of olive oil and things like that from your home, as it were, your home territory, your city. So you've got to buy those. How do you buy them? Well, you can barter, but most of the time it's credit. And this is the key thing. Credit actually happened a long time before money. And if you like, money was it crystallized credit. And that was basically the function. It's still the function today. So this idea that you can have credit without money, mm-hmm. In other words, a fiat currency with derivatives from there, is basically flawed. It's putting the cart before the horse. What you need is you need to have something to secure the value of your credit. And if we go on from Roman times, I mean, basically, you had a number of people who wrote about this and defined things. There was a Roman juror called Alpian. There's another one called Paulus. And what they wrote about credit was virtually inserted verbatim into the Justinian Pandects, which were around about 550 AD. So that was about 1,000 years after the 12 tables. Mm-hmm. Now, Justinian was an emperor in the Eastern Empire, but the laws were all written in Latin. Now, this was obviously an unsatisfactory situation when most of the people who ended up in court were Greek and couldn't speak Latin. So, the situation evolved, and towards the, I think, about 890s, something like that, this was all put together in something called the Basilica. And this was called the Basilica because it was at the time of Basil the First and his son. So what happened? I mean, that was in Greek. So really what happened, being, putting it simplistically, is that the Basilica basically sort of spread along with the Orthodox Church into generally Eastern Europe, including Russia and so on, whereas the Pandects spread into the Western Empire and the successor nations. And of course, who colonized the world? Well, there was us, there was the Spaniards, there was the Portuguese. don't forget the Portuguese. They were enormous, enormous adventurers. There was also the Dutch with the Spice Islands and so on and so forth. So we spread these laws around the world. So guess what? In every country, the basis of monetary law is gold is money. Mm-hmm. The rest is credit. Mm-hmm. And this is terribly, terribly important to understand. And, if you have a government that suggests otherwise, it's propaganda. It's incorrect. They're actually in breach of their own laws. They're trying to persuade you something which suits them. Actually is not the legal position. So in a nutshell, that's basically it.
Yeah. Well, certainly the founders of our republic, the American Republic, understood that gold is money. It was written into our law, gold and silver. It was sort of basically understood. So what, maybe you could just talk a little bit for, because I really think, Alistair, a lot of people don't really understand how our current monetary system, I mean, how money is created in our current monetary system. Could you maybe just take a minute to explain that to people? Because I think it's, for most people, it's a mystery. You know, I mean, my son, when he was in junior high school, his teacher was still telling him that the dollar was backed by gold. This was not that long ago. And so ignorance reigns supreme. Most people think the dollars they carry around actually have value, that they're intrinsically valuable, but actually, as you point out, you know, I have a $5 bill here that was convertible into silver at one time back in the days, I think, Lyndon Johnson, yet it was still possible to take your $5 bill to the bank and get an ounce of silver at that time. But people think there's really something behind it, but there's actually nothing except a promise to pay. That's why you say it's credit, right?
Mm. Yeah, exactly that. Exactly that. But of course, you know, the laws that you have there, you inherited from us because you were one of our colonies at one stage.
Yes, I know.
I hate to remind you.
Yes, no, that's fine to remind me. As a matter of fact, I think most Americans aren't even aware of that these days. And when we have our 4th of July celebration, I say, well, what are these people celebrating? Do they really know what they're celebrating? I suspect not. I think there's more prestige now in your monarchy than there is in our presidency in the minds of most Americans. Well, in our current president and several before him, perhaps. But anyway.
Well, yes.
A quick explanation in terms of how money is created right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you've got two sorts of currency, if you like, or credit. The one is central bank credit, and we're familiar with that in the form of banknotes, which are issued by the Federal Reserve Board. And in accounting terms, what happens is that appears on their balance sheet as one of their liabilities. It's a liability to you. And, you know, this is not something which is just a sort of, oh, well, you know, this is just, it doesn't mean anything. Not at all. This is a balance sheet liability of the Fed to you as a holder of whichever notes you happen to have. Mm-hmm. There is now in central banks, there is another element of this, and they have a liability which is not in public circulation, and that's to commercial banks in the form of reserves. But I'm not going to complicate the issue and go through that. We move on to commercial banks. Now, commercial banks issue credit in the form of a deposit account. Now, what a deposit account is, it's a promise by the bank to pay you, essentially, I mean, originally it was in money, but more likely it's either in central bank notes or alternatively, it will allow you to transfer on your demand the credit that the bank owes you to another bank. Now, this can happen, let us say, when you pay someone who's, you know, done a service for you or you know, sold you something, you do a bank transfer. And you can do this very conveniently with a debit card, or you can do it with a slightly delayed payment system with credit cards, which you settle at the end of the month. But the point is that a commercial bank owes you funds. It owes mm-hmm. you currency. It owes you, originally it was money, but it's really now currency. And that's it. And the creation of that is really quite simple. I'll give you an example. Let us say that you go to a bank and you want to borrow $1 million for some sort of project. You convince the bank that this is a good idea. So they grant you the facility. You sign the paperwork. And as you go out of the door, the bank manager shakes your hand. And he says, well, Jay, the money's now in your account. Now, what does he mean by that? What he means is that in his bookkeeping, he's registered your loan as an asset to the bank, but under double entry bookkeeping, he has to have a balancing entry on the other side of his balance sheet, mm-hmm. and that's your deposit account. Mm-hmm. Now, he may not present his accounts in quite that form, But that is essentially the accounting process. It may come as a surprise to people to know that nobody is involved in this. It's just created out of thin air.
Right.
But actually, it's not that much different from you coming to an agreement, let us say, with someone to do some building work on your property. Now, you know, they'll give you a quote and you say, okay, that's fine, right, please go ahead. And what happens is that the workmen start working on the project. Now, you don't pay them until it's finished. So actually what's happening is that the person providing the service and agreeing to do so is effectively granting you credit. He is saying you don't need to pay until the job is finished. When the job is finished, you extinguish that credit by paying him. So actually what the bank does, I mean, you know, again, there's no one else involved. You have created a credit out of thin air.
Right.
Or rather the, you know, the builder has created a credit out of thin air against which there's a balancing debt, which gets extinguished when the work is done.
Right.
And I think it's very, very important to understand this process. We all create credit this way. We all do.
No.
Bank credit is merely a formalized way of doing it with parties who are doing this on a proper business basis. That's all bank credit is. But we all do, you know, we all use credit, if you like, in our day-to-day lives. I mean, earlier on, I referred to the Phoenicians, you know, who are setting out on a venture to, you know, try and procure things which your city needs, or you can sell into your city for credit, guess it, you know, whatever. You've got to get the credit from various people in addition to what you put in order to finance the voyage. Now, you know, if you've got a world of effectively barter, then this is something which is rather like the relationship you have with the guy doing the building work in your home. It is like that. You know, look, you know, you do the work and I'll pay you at the end. It's rather like, you know, you help me get the victuals together and all the rest of it, you know, and help me with the slaves. Let me borrow some of your slaves. We will row our quinquereem way over there and we will pick up these exotic fruits and exotic this and exotic that and metals and things like that, which we can't procure here. We will bring them back and then we can settle up.
Yeah.
And we'll settle up, you know, whichever. I mean, it'll be sort of trading goods, whatever, for, you know, sort of on agreed values against each other rather than with money. So that, you know, so credit really existed first, and it is nobody uses money. I mean, in the form of physical gold, physical silver. Even silver and copper have been changed into tokens. They're no longer coins. You know, we have these sham coins which just look like silver and look like copper, but they're nothing of the sort. So nobody uses money. They all use credit in different forms.
All right, well, nobody's using money. Then why are central banks hoarding gold? Why has there been now in the last number of years, I think for the last couple of decades, the Chinese have been accumulating massive amounts of gold. I'm hearing recently that over the last few years, a lot of the countries, central banks in Asia and around the world, not the United States and countries aligned with the US, but around the world, especially in Asia, there's been a growing interest in hoarding gold. It is money, whether governments acknowledge it or not. Why are they doing that? And it sounds, you know, you talk about credit, it sounds pretty good. It sounds like it works extremely well. Why fool around with gold? After all, Alistair, it's very difficult to mine this stuff. And here's one of the things I hear all the time. There's not enough gold in the world. There's not enough gold to satisfy the demands for money.
Yeah. Well,
for commerce.
Okay, well, starting with the central banks, you know, they're looking at their dollars. I mean, you know, it's not dollar notes, it's ledger entries. And they're sort of thinking, hold on a minute, the Fed is deep into negative equity. Do I really want to hold dollars? The ECB is deep into negative equity. Do I want to hold euros? The Bank of Japan is deep into negative equity. Do I want to hold yen? No, I think I've got to go back to real money where there is no counterparty risk.
Mm-hmm.
They realize this. Now, the last people who to part with this gold, of course, are the central banks. They don't want to part with it. They won't give it to their citizens. They won't say to their citizens, tell you what, we will fix our credit. Let's say in, you know, I don't know. You know, whatever currency. We'll fix our credit, francs or whatever it is, Swiss francs, whatever, in gold. And we will exchange francs at a guaranteed rate. So, you know, that will tie the franc credit to the value of gold. Oh, but we might have to part with some of our gold. We can't do that.
Yeah.
You can see that, you can see where, you know, they're taking this damn seriously. They really are. And it's a fascinating situation. There's another problem, I think, on top of that. And that is that quite a lot of the central banks in the West have bought the Keynesian Kool-Aid.
Mm-hmm.
And decided that, oh, well, I suppose for show, we better hang on to some of this stuff. Canada's decided to ditch it completely.
Yeah.
You know, we got rid of most of ours back in the year 2000 when the price was a little bit below the current level.
200 and some dollars or something.
Like $1,800 below the
current level.
Very nearly. The other thing, of course, is that quite a lot of the gold which the Western Alliance central banks show on their books has got at least two owners to it because they've leased it out. You know, we got this situation. I think it was Buffett who said something about, you know, when the tide goes out, you see who's wearing shorts. Yeah. Well, that is likely to be a problem. If we get, and it's going this way, if we get a banking crisis, which looks like taking down credit in the form of these currencies. And this is why it's desperately important to understand the difference between money and credit. Because we are on the verge, potentially on the verge, of a complete collapse of our credit-based system. And, you know, the error was not, you know, was to remove the tie from, you know, between credit and money. I mean, the amazing thing is that if you look at the statistics going back into the 19th century of the circulating medium, which is the sum total of, you know, money and credit, bank credit between 1844 and 1900 expanded 11 times.
Mm-hmm.
Now, yet the price, you know, the price index, the wholesale price index, you know, and these things are sort of calculated and not necessarily terribly scientific, but the one thing that we could see was that price, you know, the general level of prices in 1844 was exactly the same as the general level of prices in the year 1900,
mm-hmm.
in spite of the quantity of credit expanding to 12 times. So why was it that, you know, the monetarists who would have predicted a fall in the purchasing power of circulating currency, why are they wrong? Well, the answer is quite simple, because the credit has attached its value to gold in that case. And we saw the same, you know, with America under the, you know, the least realistic of gold exchange systems under Bretton Woods.
Yeah.
The expansion of money supply in America between 1950 and 1970 was, I think we're looking at somewhere like sort of 8-9 times, and yet prices were stable. The price of oil from 1950 to 1971 was $2.57 a barrel. You know, so so that's, you know, I think that's those are the things that one has to understand about this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a bit, but one of the reasons for not going back to some sort of a system backed by gold that's given is that there's simply not enough gold around. There's not enough gold existing to accommodate trade. But actually, it would depend on the price of gold, right? If the price of gold was high,
absolutely,
yeah, right.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you have if you have a rubbish currency, in other words, you've overissued it in credit terms and you haven't anchored the credit, then the market's probably going to say, well, the sort of rate we're looking at is $10,000. I don't know, whatever. But it's a rate which is really set by the market, not by central banks. But once it's set, they then have to behave, which for a central bank is quite a difficult ask.
Well, you had mentioned earlier that there are people, obviously people who don't want stable prices. There are people who benefit from inflation. And there are people that actually, lots of people that I know, friends that I know, have done very well in the stock market over the last couple of decades. They're quite happy with the way things have gone. The reallocation of wealth to the people that already had some savings had put it into the market. They're quite happy, and they don't like this idea of gold at all, Alistair, the idea of stable prices. Who does it help? Who does this system of this credit-based system help? And who does it hurt?
It actually, well, I mean, the credit-based system, is a reality.
Yes.
This is where I have a bit of an argument with Austrian economists who think you should do away with credit. They're not really being realistic. Credit is there. The key to it is to have it anchored. If you anchor it to the price of gold, then what happens is that borrowing rates will fall to a level which reflects a stable purchasing power over the period of a loan. So if you're going to, let's say you decide that you're going to invest in production, and it means building new factory facilities, obtaining new equipment, then you've got to get the raw materials, the labor, the expertise, and all these things. You put them all together, that is going to cost you a lot of upfront money. Somewhere down the road, maybe 5 years ago, 5 years' time, you will start rolling stuff off the production line and start earning as a result of your investment. What you need to be able to do is to know what the final value of that product is going to be. So, if you look at, let's say, you're in Russia now, at the moment, with the ruble, which is not highly regarded as a currency. Interest rates in the order of what, 9, 10%. I mean, a commercial borrower would probably have to pay something like 12, 13, 14%. But if that fell to somewhere between 3, 4, maybe 5% for a non-prime borrower, then, suddenly quite a lot of production begins to make a lot of sense. You can actually put together a proper business plan. So, even though you would say that people enjoying credit, which is losing purchasing power over time, are benefiting from this, they're not necessarily improving their overall position. They start relying on the depreciation of the currency over time. They certainly rely on a central bank which engineers those conditions by suppressing interest rates, by increasing the quantity of central bank originated credit, and say, wow, this is wonderful. But that's fine until reality begins to catch up. And so we saw this, for example, with Silicon Valley Bank, who gamed it. I mean, it was quite simple. With interest rates down at zero, they could borrow overnight money at zero and put it in 10-year treasuries for an uplift of, say, 0.75%. And if you gear your balance sheet 20 times, wow, oh, so easy. I don't need to, for goodness sake, I don't have to be clever to do this. This is so easy. But then what happens is the Fed loses control over the situation for various reasons. Interest rates start rising. The yield on the bond starts rising as well, which means the prices collapse. So you've got, first of all, your financing of the position is beginning to cost more than the coupon return because you probably bought a 10-year US Treasury with a 1% coupon and you're paying 5% now. So you're immediately locking in losses of 4% on your profit and loss account. And the other thing is that you've got buried in your balance sheet, on a sort of, well, held to maturity basis, which basically means you can't sell it because you got damn great losses. Are your bonds? I mean, they have probably lost 30% of their value. So, suddenly, I mean, all this gearing you've got, giving your shareholders this wonderful return, I mean, suddenly it's worked against you and you wiped out your shareholders' equity. And of course, as soon as the depositors realize this, they run for the hills. Hence, we got a banking crisis. And if you understand that, you can see why this banking crisis has only just started. Unless you believe that the Fed can regain control over interest rates and suppress them with the dollar remaining nice and strong.
Well, I
Dream
guess
on, dream on is all I would say.
you can dream of the tooth fairy as well. And the point is that, well, for example, we saw the CPI come in a couple of days back, softer than the market was expecting. So the interest rates on the 10-year and other bonds, treasuries went down. Markets rejoiced, went up very strongly to start with. But I believe it's your view, Alistair, correct me if I'm wrong, that interest rates are going to continue to rise, that the Fed has, in fact, probably or has lost control. I don't, am I overstating that, or is that your view? I may be wrong.
No, you're not overstating it at all, but it's for reasons which I think are not generally understood. The fact of the matter is that we can see that bank credit, commercial bank credit, is now contracting. This is reflected in a number of statistics. And when you look at things like loan officers' surveys, when you look at the headline statistic and all these things, you can see that suddenly there is an element of fear in there, fear of losses. The banks are beginning to be frightened that their leverage is going to lead to losses they cannot afford. So they want to reduce their balance sheets down. Now, what that means is that credit becomes scarce. And when credit becomes scarce, all those people who've relied on credit, who find that, because let's say sales have not sort of met expectations, so they've got less income with all those costs, they've got maybe accumulating inventory, all these things, they need more credit. So they go to the bank and say, look, don't cut us off. We need to expand our credit facilities from you. In which case, the bank either says, go and talk to someone else, or the bank says, well, we can't lend you quite as much as you want, and what we will lend you will come at a higher price. So what we see is that with contracting bank credit, pure, simple supply and demand for credit means that the price of credit, in other words, what you have to pay in interest rates, will rise. And I think that's the future. And there is another aspect on this, and that is that the foreigners overown dollars. I mean, I know we've talked about this before, but did you know that the foreign ownership of bank deposits is 40% of the total US bank deposits? 40%. Now, if they decide that they don't want to hold dollars, which means that they will reduce their positions, and while many of your listeners in America would think that this is unlikely because it's a reserve currency and all the rest of it, just note the number of countries which are turning their back on the dollar as a means of trade settlement. So if they're turning their back on the dollar, why should they hold on to such enormous reserves? And we're not talking just about nations, we're also talking about commercial entities who are doing the trade. Where they're free, let us say, to store whatever currency they want. So if they start selling down the dollar, this is going to hit it badly. Now, what happens then is, how does the Fed respond? Well, it might try and use its swap lines as a means of supporting the currency. But the swap line issue is too small for this. I mean, we're talking about trying to stem a tide of around about $7 trillion with swap lines, which were typically in the order of 20 or 50 billion. It can't be done. So it will actually force the Fed to go along with higher interest rates if that happens. And I think we're pretty much on the verge of it. What I would say is the thing to watch is the dollar's trade-weighted index. If that dips below 100, the dollar is toast. I think that would be a big signal to foreign owners, get out of the dollar, reduce your positions. And so that, I think, is the level to watch.
Where is it now, Alistair?
100.5. No, 101.5, sorry.
So it's... So
we're about a percent above it, sort of thing. What, you know...
Right, so that's something. That's something that you watch then, I guess, and talk about it from time to time.
It's
you have to really. I mean, we Americans have been able to live way beyond our means for so long, because we've had the world's reserve currency, and other countries, net export countries, were very happy to buy our treasuries, and now, so you have to wonder how high do rates have to go to clear the market? You know, how high do rates have to go? And of course, at any given time, there's a number, but it's always dynamic. It's changing. So, you know, where are we headed? I mean, if the foreigners decide they don't, I don't know who's buying U.S. treasuries from around the world now. The Chinese are reducing their holdings. I don't know if the Japanese, with their aging population, you know, who. So either it has to be monetized, our debt, which is growing dramatically, and then we have these fixed income obligations that the government has entered into with its citizens. There's no way that we can get away with it without some drastic changes inflation or something. I don't understand, because we're looking at Medicare and Social Security and those things with an aging population. Now we have a lot of people coming in, a couple of million people illegally across the border under President Biden. And I guess maybe that's not all bad. We need people to do our work. But it just seems to me that who's going to buy our treasuries, because we're so far away from balancing any kind of budget in the future. That's not even the only way that's going to happen, Alistair, I think, is if somehow economics force it on us.
Yeah, I'd go along with that. It's I mean, there will be buyers of U.S. treasuries, I would include, I think, most of the Western alliance. Yeah. I mean, I can see the Japanese, for example, you know, continuing to accumulate some. But it is getting quite hard to see who else is going to buy it. I mean, there are some elements which are pretty much automatic. I mean, the offshore insurance industry, U.S. interest dealing through the Cayman Islands, for example. That sort of thing, I think, will continue. But, I mean, there is a problem, because as the U.S. economy slows down, the funding requirements of the Biden administration are going to increase above what the Congressional Budget Office is forecasting. And it won't be very long. I mean, okay, you know, they'll come to another agreement on the debt ceiling. They always do, so that's a fair bet they will this time. But I mean, that'll be swallowed up pretty quickly, I think. And consequently, you know, it's how does the Fed going to run this circus of funding the US government at a time when foreigners start turning seller? The dollar is starting weakening below that 100 Rubicon level. And, you know, this to me has got the makings of something which is going to force interest rates up quite significantly.
Yeah.
And at what point will the Fed decide that they've got to stop supporting the economy, stop supporting the government's funding problems, and actually protect the currency? This is the John Law dilemma again, if you like. Mm-hmm. So that I can see is hoving into view. It really is. And what I mean by the John Law dilemma, for those who haven't listened to this before, is, you know, John Law was an itinerant Scotsman who persuaded the Duke of Orleans as Prince Regent that I have a plan, he said. And his plan basically was, you know, a good stockbroking ramp. Let's face it, that's what it was. The Mississippi bubble.
Yeah.
And my goodness, you know, when I was a stockbroker, you know, trying to push a stock, if I could print the credit underneath to finance it, I mean, wow, what a game, what a game. Anyway, he did this. This was absolutely fine, but predictably the thing blew up in sort of early 1720. And by the fall in that year, the Mississippi bubble had imploded. But the real collapse was the currency. The currency right. became completely valueless at that time. Right. And, we face the same sort of thing. I mean, do we do what John Law did? Do we try and protect the bubble, stop the bubble from really imploding into nothing? Yeah, we probably do.
Yeah.
Because well, that's our mandate.
Yeah, it seems the current Federal Reserve Chairman, Jay Powell, is trying to fight the good fight in some ways, it would seem. But when push comes to shove, it's hard to see how they can't going to be able to resist not just blowing the thing up with credit and expanding the whole thing. And so I mean, prices can go up, stock markets can go up as the debt instruments can rise in value. I suppose, but ultimately, if the currency is worthless, what does it mean, right?
Well, it's not just that, Jay. I mean, the interest rates will rise with a falling currency. Why?
Right.
Because people will only hold on to that currency, and we're predominantly talking about foreigners in the first instance.
Right. They'll
only hold on to it if they get some sort of recompense for their anticipation of the loss of its purchasing power value over time. If they see that not being the case, then they're going to sell. It's really as simple as that.
Yeah.
So, if you have, you're getting sort of fairly close at the moment. You can see that with the current rate of inflation, which was just announced the last couple of days, 4.9%. You got Fed funds rate close to 5%.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Sort of. Wow. But then you're not getting paid for the risk. Of the paper from the central bank, which is demonstrably bust.
Right.
So what more do we want on top of that to keep us in dollars? Now you can see that there are a number of factors. And I think, the shortage of credit is going to start driving interest rates up on another leg. And I think as people begin to anticipate that, it'll start unlocking a lot of the stuff invested in financial assets, which are going to fall in value on the back of it. So, this the outlook. I can't get optimistic about the outlook. I mean, the only thing to have, I think, is, get some of your wealth out of this credit system and into genuine money, which, coming back to the point we started this conversation, the difference between credit and genuine money. Genuine money being physical gold, physical silver, physical copper, but particularly physical gold, that's the only protection you can have. Understand the difference between money and credit. And I can tell you, very few people do.
Very few people do, and that's why we're really happy to have you here to explain it, Alistair. I think it seems to me that there's a lot of things that are just starting to play out right now. There's a lot of companies that have been still running on cheap credit that are going to have to pay their loans. They're going to, if they roll them over, they're going to have to roll them over at much higher rates. And a lot of these zombie companies have been kept alive for a long time on the respirator of zero credit, essentially. And it would seem as though there's going to be a lot more shoes to fall, I would think, in the banking system as well as in the commercial realm. Any final thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's the locked into a problem because collapsing credit. Well, it's not collapsing yet, but it's we can see that's very likely, increasingly likely outcome. I mean, that basically rebounds on the banks. I mean, the last one to cut their balance sheet obligations is a sissy. Bear in mind that it was over a year ago that James Diamond. Stood up at a conference and said, a couple of weeks ago, I reckoned that the economy was facing a storm. I'm going to correct that. I think it's a hurricane.
Yeah.
The Fed obviously slapped JP Morgan down. And so the chief economist came on and said, it's not as bad as that. Bit of backpedaling going on there. But we were warned. We were warned by the most senior commercial banker in the world.
Yeah.
And Guess what? Now the crisis is on us. What's he saying? Oh, it's not a problem. No. I don't know. We dealt with it. But he's got to say that, hasn't he? He's got to say it.
He's got to say that. But at the same time, JP Morgan is gobbling up some of these smaller, quite large banks, actually. So maybe in some ways he sees this hurricane as to his advantage. I don't know. But
I don't think so, Jay. I think he's really got virtually no alternative, because his role with the Fed, or rather JP Morgan's role with the Fed, is JP Morgan is the principal channel through which the Fed operates in the commercial banking network.
Yeah.
And it's that relationship which I think is vital. And it is impossible for JP Morgan to turn around to the Fed and say, we don't like what you're doing. We don't like the situation. We're not going to cooperate with you in taking on yet more banking liability through acquisitions. So, go and talk to someone else. That's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can see some difficult meetings. I can see negotiations to try and get something out of it for JP Morgan. I mean, for goodness sake, if you and I were in Jamie Dimon's position, that's exactly what we would do.
Sure.
It's perfectly reasonable, but it's not a good situation. And I apart from anything else, I mean, JP Morgan has got, is going to have balance sheet issues, because they just don't have the capacity on their balance sheet to take mm-hmm. on all this stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's going to become a difficulty, and I'm not quite sure how they're going to resolve that one.
Well, the too big to fail bank, that's for sure. And we'll have to see if they're too big to fail, or if Mother Nature has its way. And who knows? It's in some ways, it's hard to know when or exactly how things are going to unfold. But one thing we can be pretty sure of, Alistair, and I think one of the charts that you show that make the best case for owning gold, and that is that chart that shows the price of oil in gold going back, I don't know how far, but certainly since Bretton Woods breakdown, it has, as you just said, I think it's like $2 or $2 to $3 a barrel about that time. And it stayed at the same price in terms of ounces of gold. So that's just a very good illustration of it. Any last thoughts, or in terms of where we're going? The price of gold has broken above 2000. I don't know if you're how much of a technical analyst you are, but do you see us having cleared that ceiling and maybe on to much higher prices of gold? Again, I would also just caution my viewers to remember that it's not gold going up, it's currencies that are collapsing.
Absolutely. I think very well said. Let's look at it, if you like, in the conventional way, and that is that the gold price is moving and the dollar is constant, which we know is a load of rubbish. But anyway, that is the conventional charting viewpoint. I would not rule out another test of the 2000 level. Mm-hmm. I think that is quite likely. Mm-hmm. But having said that, both gold and silver have been remarkably resilient, remarkably steady in recent weeks. Mm-hmm. There are substantial short positions on the part of the establishment, by which I mean bullion banks on COMEX. We don't know what their positions are in London, but my guess is, and I think it's, I'm pretty sure I'm right, that overall they're also short in London, though there may be some banks. And I would think that banks like JP Morgan, Hong Kong, Shanghai Bank, those who are actually quite close to either the Chinese economy or who analyze it properly, and that this will be the big banks because they have the information and everything else. So, they're going to analyze these things properly. They will realize that the defense mechanism for both China and Russia and all those neutral countries which are aligning with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, with BRICS, BRICS Plus, whatever. Mm-hmm. They're all beginning to think in terms of what are we going to have to replace the dollar? And so we're looking at currencies with a better commodity base. And the only commodity which can represent all commodities effectively is gold. Mm-hmm. Now, we don't know how they will do it, but we do know that that is the way they're thinking in Russia. We know that it's the way they're thinking in China. And, I've seen a few things trying to persuade me that the Chinese are offering swap facilities for citizens. You know, if you've got a yuan account, then you can open a gold account and you can transfer money from yuan into your gold account. Wow. And this is apparently becoming a feature, if you like, offered by all the major banks in China.
Interesting.
Now, is this a precursor to having a gold standard for the yuan? Well, it could be. Yeah. It could be. But I don't think at this stage we can really say so. Yeah. So, you know, gold basically is the way to go. We don't know exactly how it will pan out. But what we do know is that the fiat currency system faces some very difficult times. And anyone who's got all their wealth tied up in it is going to end up losing big time. That's the way it looks.
Well, I definitely agree with you there. And I should just mention that goldmoney.com is a place to go to buy gold and silver. And it's a service that I've used and have been very pleased with it. Also go to Gold Money to read Alistair's missives every Thursday it comes out. Yeah. It's one of those things I feel I can't miss. I want to thank you very much again, Alistair, for spending time with us. You're always very, very enlightening and helpful to our viewers. So thank you so much for being with us again.
That's very much my pleasure, Jay.
All right, folks. So that is it for this. Well, actually, don't go away, because I was going to tell you that's it for this week. It's not this it for this week. Quentin Henning is going to be with me in just a moment to talk about a company that I'm very high on, a company that's doing extremely well, outlining a what looks like could be a very large gold deposit in British Columbia. So don't go away. We'll be right back with Dr. Quentin Henning. Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really happy to have Quentin Henning with me again. Talk about another exciting exploration story. This one is Blue Lagoon Resources. It is a company that is sponsoring today's show. It's a company that I've been following for a number of years. Actually, I knew the founder of the company going back quite a few years, maybe 10 years ago or so. And when Crescat Capital got involved with it, I said, well, maybe this is something I should look at. And I did put it in my newsletter. I do own the shares myself, and I'm really happy that Quentin is here to help investors understand this, I think, what is a very exciting story. Thank you so much for joining me, Quentin.
Pleasure, Jay.
Yeah, it's always good to have you with me. Maybe you should mention that trades in Canada under the symbol BLLG. BLAGF in the States, that's how I bought it. 101.3 million shares, I think, about 19 cents in US money, something like that. So it's a really small market cap, under 20 million in US funds. I saw at the end of the year, the company had about a little under $3 million in cash. So it's probably gonna need to raise some money along the way, especially if they get involved aggressively in what I think they should. Because it has a great potential. They do have a small resource, 250,000 ounces, I think, in their project on Dome Mountain, pretty high grade, I believe maybe around 9 grams per ton and near surface. They have that going for them for sure, but I think they have an awful lot more than that in terms of their exploration potential. So that's really why I'm really happy to have Quentin with me again. All right, their Dome Mountain project. How do you describe it? I think I've heard you say it's an alkaline system, perhaps.
It is. It's a variety of alkaline gold systems, and what that means is it's associated with magma that came up that has a lot of alkaline metal in it. Okay, and this magma, which had a lot of potassium and other metals like sodium and stuff, came up, parked itself somewhere short distance down from the Earth's surface, say 2 or 3 kilometers, and then started to basically crystallize. And as it did so, flushed a lot of metal up into the veins and fractures above that chamber. And this is a kind of model that I talk about for stories like Tuvatu at Lion One. Mm-hmm. So it's a pretty typical model. A lot of people think, these are epithermal veins, like hot spring veins. They're not really, okay, because they're deep rooted. They're not just sitting there boiling in kind of a relatively shallow regime. These are deep rooted gold systems that can go down quite some distance. In fact, there's systems that are very, very much like the Dome Mountain system that we know about around the world that have profiles that are well over a kilometer vertically into the ground. The best example I can think of is Buriticá, which is in Colombia. It's a gold project that was advanced many years by Continental Gold and then was bought out by the Chinese a few years ago. Its vein system, they're very subtle veins, okay? They tend not to have a lot of flashy alteration. So you got to drill them to figure out what's going on. But once you find one of these veins, they tend to be fairly continuous along strike and fairly continuous at depth. It's not to say they're fully mineralized, you know, every inch of the way, but the fracture themselves, the actual profile of the vein, can go down a long, long way. And I see that kind of potential here at Dome Mountain.
Yeah. So they have a resource of, and I think there was some talk about having it custom milled, or they'd mine it. Would probably bring in some outside miners and have it custom milled, or how would they do it?
So the project was in the hands of a private company. They actually acquired it from the private company. And the previous owners tried to develop a small scale mine here. It is a rich vein, as you mentioned, the Dome, or the Boulder vein at Dome Mountain is quite rich. And they were able to mine and extract, you know, a bulk sample a couple of years ago and process it. And they actually, I believe, netted some money out of it. So not often you see that, not often you see a bulk, you know, sample generate some cash, but it is high grade and it's very prolific. So, you know, look, it is developable. Okay. I think there's a story to be made here. I'm focused on the exploration potential, but do I see potential to build a mine? Yes, you know, but my focus in particular is going to be on the exploration story around that.
Mm-hmm. All right. I think I saw the other day when you were talking about this story on Crescat Gets Active, you had a cross section or a long section, I guess you call it.
Yeah.
That really showed some of the high grade intercepts, but not all that deep, but they're open. It's open in every direction, it seems, pretty much a long strike and at depth anyway. So do you have that image you could show us?
I sure do. Yes, I did show this image the other day on the Crescat video. This is a long section. Basically what we're looking at is the vein in profile. So we're not looking straight down on it. We've rotated the vein. So now we're looking at it from the side. And we can see all the drill holes that have gone into this. The different colors tell you what the grade thickness, the grams per gold over the meter widths were in each of these drill holes. Obviously, up in the top there where those little tiny squares are, that's the block model. That's the current resource. And like you said, it's about 250,000 ounces. It is high grade. It is running on the order of 9 or 10 grams per ton. But it is a modest scale resource. Now notice there's some levels in there, okay? There's some actual tunnel levels or adit levels. And those are where this development has been done to date, okay? Some bulk sampling, blocks have been mined out. That's actually where the white is inside those block models. That's probably been mined away. All right, but that is the current resource, but notice that there's a lot of drill holes away from that area. Okay, we've got holes off here to the east or to the right. We got holes down at depth. We've got holes off to the west as well. Now, it's important to understand that in any vein system, you're never going to hit 100%. Okay, there are places where the fluids, when they came up the crack, they mineralize the rock quite well or mineralize the fracture quite well. And then there's going to be other places where they didn't mineralize it so well. Okay, so the blues and the greens are lower grade areas. The reds, oranges, pinks and stuff, those are higher grade areas, typical of any vein, all right? You can see this kind of pattern any vein on Earth. All right, now what's astounding though to me is that they have, with the wide space drilling that they've done outside of that resource, they have started to define a much, much broader footprint. Okay, so, you know, it's not hard to say in your head, okay, if that's 250,000 ounces and we take that block model shape and we kind of replicate that, you know, it's not hard to say, okay, there's probably, you know, room for 3 or 4 more of these on that, just this image here, okay? And it's not to say it's cut off a long strike either, but right there, if that's 250,000 ounces, I say yes, there's a good shot they could have a million and a half ounces just by replicating that over and over again. And these drill holes that they have outside of there clearly demonstrate that's a possibility. Look over here on the right hand side, hole 273 hit 5.5 grams gold, 1.2% copper over 16 meters of width. True width is about 12 meters. 12 meters, that's a long way. Okay, that's the width of your average house or something. Yeah. I think that, like, that's a big volume of rock. You know, so it doesn't take a lot of volume or like a lot of strike and stuff to build tons when you're dealing with that kind of width. Okay, and to me, that hit looks like it's down plunge. Mm-hmm. Look up to the upper left. See where it says 530 meters that's written?
Right.
You can see there's a band of pink forming, and it trends down in that direction towards 273. That's what we call the rake or this projection of a high-grade chute. And I think that they hit the down plunge projection of that very high-grade chute. Mm-hmm. That's one example. Okay, lots of upside. But then you have other intercepts. Skinnier, yes, but they're also interesting. Like down here, hole 139, mm-hmm. you got 17.7 grams of gold, 0.3% copper, a little lower, but over 3.13 meters. That's about 2 meters true width. That's plenty wide to mine. I mean, you're talking about half ounce rock with a mm-hmm. Copper credit to throw in.
Sure.
Over 2 meters. That's an awesome result. All right. So, you know, what am I seeing here? I'm seeing the company start to define a picture that really does look like this could evolve into a multi-million ounce gold system. Now, you might say, well, what other analogies can we look at around the world where you have you have a small scale mine where somebody, you know, decided to go in, albeit didn't advance it all that far, but that evolved into a big gold story? Well, the one I look at that is also an alkaline system, very similar in nature to this, is K92, which is in Papua New Guinea.
Hmm.
All right, so you know this. What this reminds me of is the early days of K92. K92, of course, is in Papua New Guinea, and they started mining a deposit very similar to this. In fact, it's an alkaline gold system. It's got a copper gold flavor to it, and it is a vein hosted system, much like this, very high grade. And they started mining. This is going back a few years ago when they wanted to demonstrate the economic viability of it. And that morphed into a full-scale commercial mine, which they're doing now. But at the same time, they started to explore. They started to explore the vein systems,
mm-hmm.
Continuations of those veins around the mine. And today they're at a few million ounces. I think it's like 3 or 4 million ounces of reserves. That they have in front of them. That's an astounding result. This is the kind of system we're dealing with here. And I see a very similar pattern evolving. I think that give these guys a couple of years. I think, you know, not only could they develop this small scale mine, but they do have potential to have just kind of an astounding exploration story to tag along with that, mm-hmm. that can demonstrate that this is going to be a very high profitable mine over a very long period.
Mm-hmm. Quentin, as I look at this cross section, I see that they were able to go in through the side of the mountain pretty much the levels that they're mining from now. If they were to go a lot deeper, though, they'd probably have to put in an incline or something, right?
Yes, they would obviously to chase these high grade chutes, these high grade plumbing systems down to depth. They'd have to put in further development, but you know the fact that they're seeing. Fully 150, 200 meters below the existing mine workings, they're seeing, you know, very good, widths, very good grades like this. This should easily support that kind of development.
But do we know anything about the strike length of this system?
You know, they did some drilling earlier, after they hit the grades here in 273. They did some drilling further to the east, so I know that it's open. I think some of their results from recent news shows that it continues further east, like a few hundred meters to the east. But they also had some drill holes off to the west as well. I think the 280 and 283 that you see in this image were examples of that. You know, look at there, 283, 7.3 grams over about a 2.75 meter true width. Mm-hmm. Width a nearly 1% copper contribution. That is really good material, yeah. Jay. That's phenomenal. Yeah. You know, and then up there in hole 280, you got 3.14 meter true width. Okay, that's plenty wide to mine. 8.68 gram per ton gold, and not quite as high copper, but still a significant copper component. Again, an astounding outcome for drilling. This tells me that this thing's wide open along strike. There's absolutely nothing cutting this thing off, and it could have a profile very much like what you see at K92.
Mm. So what does this company need to do? I mean, it's under $20 million market cap. It's got, if it has these kind of grades, I mean, an aggressive drill program, it seems to me, Quentin, if you could start to see multi-million ounce deposit of something like of that nature with high grades, obviously the market would start to get excited about it, I would think.
I do think this is one of the more compelling, you know, vein projects in British Columbia, certainly. I think that the potential's here, like multi-million ounce potential for sure. What do they need to do? They need to certainly explore. They need to do bold, aggressive step-out drilling and try to continue to hit holes like this. I don't think they need to do infill just yet, but if they show that this thing could have a footprint that could host a few million ounces, that's going to catch people's attention. I think they're getting close to it now, but they need to continue that work. So there's one element. Now, developing a mine, you know what? K92, it worked. They got in there and they built a modest scale mine that eventually scaled up and mm-hmm. is now a full scale commercial mine that is making great money. That is certainly possible here. If they started to get a picture of enough resource and reserves in front of them to develop that kind of scenario, I think this is another case where you could build a K92 story. Now, what's the upside? Well, this is in British Columbia. I'm going to say British Columbia is a little more favorable than Papua New Guinea. So I think, you know, I would actually be pretty keen to see something like that happen here.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the management team, they do have some engineering capabilities there, I guess. So I guess that's good if they're a producer.
Yes, that's correct. They got engineering and then, you know, there are small mine companies, you know, contract firms in British Columbia area. I'm sure that they can find the team that they need to build a small scale to start with, but you know, a mine that could be ramped up. Mm-hmm. And I think they have a bit of permitting they need to go through to get to that stage, but I think they're working towards that.
Oh, certainly like to see that and see them become more aggressive, I guess, in terms of, do they have geologists on staff?
Yeah, Bill Kronk is their technical main technical person. Yeah. He's got a few people working under him. Not, you know, a big team. It's a pretty small team.
Yeah.
Yeah, they do have a decent team. They've got to probably up their team as this project takes off. Like mm-hmm. I can see where, you know, in a good gold market, it's, you know, time to start moving and shaking. I think they're going to need to raise some money, like you said.
Yeah.
And probably beef up things. But this is just a killer project that will certainly justify the capital that they need to go out and get things going.
Well, it'd be nice if they can generate some cash flow and help to fund their exploration. But what you're saying is you see the need right now to establish the scale of this thing with you know, step out drilling. No need to closely drill right now, except maybe what they're going to mine. They want to know exactly where the cutoffs are and so forth. But this looks like a very exciting story. I hope that they start to become more aggressive in their drilling. Obviously, they're going to have to raise some money. But if they can, at least if the market can start to realize what the potential is here, maybe, who knows, maybe we can see the share price improve, especially with the higher gold price the wind at our back now, Quentin, a little bit, over $2,000. It's looking very bullish for gold. So let's hope.
It does indeed, but Jay, yes, this looks like a market that might come back with, you know, we'll call it a resounding bull here soon. I think, like, you know, every technical indicator, I know that you talked to Kevin and Tavi recently, and I don't pretend to be a macro economist, but I, you know, as a geologist and watching these cycles, this one looks like it's setting up to be a big one.
Sure does. Well, thank you very much, Quentin, for sharing this with us and helping people understand what the prospects are. Of Blue Lagoon are. It's greatly appreciated. All right, folks. Well, that is it for this week. Next week, I expect to have Michael Oliver with me and probably another guest or two. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.